place that I did has given me certain historical, cultural, and political perspectives that I have shared from time to time with you. With your forbearance, I have another one for today. I remember what I'll call the "at least you don't have to live with them" tactic. Some politicians in my part of the world in the early, in the 50s and 60s, took a pretty effective use. The "them" being referred to were African Americans. The polite company term then was colors. The message in this tactic, which was primarily directed towards working class white folks who were usually struggling just to make ends meet, went something like this. Your lot in life may not be all that great. You're not sure how well you can provide for your kids. The house you live in is probably in disrepair and not big enough to support your family, provide to house your family. And economically speaking, you don't have a whole heck of a lot to look forward to. By gosh and by golly, at least you're not going to have colored people in your neighborhood or going to school with your kids. Because that sort of thing, after all, would upset the moral order of things. And the next thing you know, they'll be marrying your sons and daughters, sisters and daughters. In 1964, Bob Dylan, very young at that time, wrote a song about this tactic and called "Only a Pawn in Their Game." Some of you who are of my generation may remember it. I witnessed political careers launched over this tactic, or with this tactic, and interestingly enough, one of those careers was that of Robert C. Byrd, senior senator from West Virginia, and now the senior member of the United States Senate itself, following Strom Thurmond's demise. My one-time senator has come a long way since those days, and I admire him for that. I admire his willingness to correct the errors of his earlier ways. For as much of a liberal hero as he became in his opposition to the Iraqi war, I do remember, back when I was in college, his hard-fought and ultimately unsuccessful attempt to defeat the 1964 Civil Rights Bill when it was before the United States Senate 40 years ago. He was a senator back then, too, believe it or not. The young, at that time, senator knew his constituency, who were largely hardworking, plain living, Southern Appalachian white people, who really felt that some kind of moral order would be upset if race mixing, as it was called, was allowed to happen. The young senator played well with that constituency, saw him as protecting them against some kind of moral decay in the body politic. Those days, for the most part, thankfully, are well gone. But there seems to be a 2004 version of that same sad and sorry game and tactic afoot. It goes something like this. My employment situation may be precarious. My health care benefits may be woefully inadequate. My elderly father and mother can't afford the prescription drugs they need unless they can figure out a way to get them from Canada. And my son or daughter may wind up being killed in Iraq. But by gosh and by golly, at least I don't have to live in a country where gay people can get married. That, after all, would upset the moral order of things. No, I don't believe the recently completed presidential election turned on any one particular issue, be it same-sex marriage or any other. I've seen some post-election vote analysis that does suggest that. I've seen other analyses that refute the notion. That kind of dissection, interesting and useful as it may be in some quarters, is not where I'm going to go this morning. We've had a very full, rich service already today, and even if you're a political junkie, you may have hit the OD level when it comes to post-election commentary. But since the issue of moral values and what they are and who can best uphold them did play an important role in the presidential election, I did not want to let the matter pass by without at least some commentary about it. I will acknowledge that in some sections of our national electorate, the term moral values did serve as a code phrase for mobilizing anti-same-sex marriage and anti-abortion sentiment. But the issue itself is bigger than these matters. No society can operate by laws or by political processes alone. It cannot operate without such things, to be sure, but it also operates with an underlying sense of some commonly held moral values and precepts. And when it looks like that moral order is threatened, people get anxious. How realistic or rational the threat actually is comes to not even matter a whole lot. Those people from my youth who felt that some kind of moral order would be undermined if the races were allowed to intermingle, they weren't bad people. For the most part, they weren't irrational people in the overall sense. They just had a view, misguided and misinformed, of how the world was supposed to work. And they wanted to make sure it kept working that way. By the same token, as I see it, there is no rational reason to believe or that can be demonstrated that if persons of the same sex can enter into a legal marriage, that some moral order will come crashing down. But if enough people, good, clean living, hardworking, people who are not, in the overall sense, irrational, believe that it will, then perception becomes reality, regardless of how much reality it actually has. And playing to perceptions, whether they have any reality behind them or not, is hardly a new tactic when it comes to electoral politics. It's been around as long as there have been political orders of any kind. Well, to reiterate what I just said, no society operates by laws and governmental processes alone. It also operates with an underlying sense of certain widely held moral values and precepts. It is how these moral values and precepts are determined and who sets the tone for them that is crucial when it comes to the larger health and stability of a society and culture itself. The fact that Jerry Falwell would fully agree with those last two sentences of mine, even though he may dismiss everything else I have to say today, does not detract from their truth. My topic, then, is whose moral values? I begin by noting that I pose the question as a liberal religious minister to a liberal religious congregation who extends to me both the privilege and the blessing of being its minister and spiritual leader. While many of us, I know, myself certainly included, have strong political opinions and convictions which we strongly act upon, we in this community are not, in our basic essence, a political action committee or organization. As a liberal religious community, we do seek to uphold and live out among ourselves a set of moral values articulated in our purposes and principles that we also believe would well serve the needs and aspirations of a larger world community. And so our calling is to embody, to incarnate among ourselves the values that we think would best make the beloved community that we envision for humanity itself. We cannot save the world in its entirety. We can live and act in accordance with how we believe a saved world would look and behave, and then work towards that end. In acting in such a way, we cannot, of course, ignore the workings of the political world. But our concern should not primarily be on whether or not we are on the correct side of a particular political agenda, but whether or not we're on the right side of history. To explain what I mean by this, I want to revisit something I talked about a few weeks ago. I want to revisit the guidance I take from the life and work of Martin Luther King. Yes, the man had his personal moral shortcomings, but his example of what it means to exercise moral leadership and bring moral issues to bear upon a society like ours is, I believe, unparalleled in our nation's history, certainly in the 20th century at least. He was the premier moral leader in this country in the 20th century. Dr. King's theology, his way of believing in God, as I also pointed out, pointed out a few weeks ago, was that of God as a spiritual force who acts in human history and through human agents to call and bring humanity itself to greater levels of justice, compassion, wholeness, and peace. Dr. King believed that the ongoing human journey was ultimately in the hands of someone or something greater than himself, and that his role was to participate in that journey towards greater human wholeness and to call others to participate with him. Dr. King was fond of quoting a line from a hymn from his own African-American spiritual tradition that said, "I know not what the future holds, but I know who holds the future." Now, I'm not out to sell you on the finer points of Martin Luther King's theology this morning. Some of you may resonate with it, some not. But I believe you would do well to cultivate the worldview and the perspective that comes out of that theology, whether you accept the theology itself or not. And that worldview, that perspective, is to believe that the moral values and principles and stances we seek to uphold in the present, whether they happen to flow in something called the political mainstream or not, are part of a larger journey towards human wholeness. Had Dr. King decided to wait until those issues of racial justice that burn within him and within those who look to him for leadership had widespread political acceptance and viability, there would have been no civil rights movement. We are called then to participate in that larger journey towards human wholeness, whose full fruition and fulfillment we may or may not see in our lifetimes, but whose fruition and fulfillment will be accomplished nonetheless. To believe this is what it means, indeed, to live by faith and to live as a faith community. In the nearly 2 weeks that have passed since the election, the president of our Unitarian Universalist Association, the Reverend William Sinkford, has issued two statements, each of which has bearing on what I'm trying to share today. I want to offer portions of both. The first came on November 3rd, the day after. It said, in part, "Today, while so many celebrate and so many grieve, I hope that Unitarian Universalists will hold fast to our call. Few votes were cast yesterday without reservations of the heart. Our congregations need to be religious homes, where the reality of joy and grief, certainty and uncertainty, can be present." In 1964, the Reverend Jack Mendelson wrote a book called Being Liberal in an Illiberal Age. Today, Jack reminded me that all ages are illiberal. And thus, in every age, it is the role of liberal religion to offer a gospel of openness, of healing, and of hope. Our profession of faith is that the arc of the universe is long, but with our commitment, it bends towards justice. And then this past Tuesday, as the moral values issue came to the fore, Reverend Sinkford had this to say in his capacity as UUA president at a gathering of religious leaders before the National Press Club in Washington. Here's part of what he said there. "Moral values are not just particular opinions on hot-button topics in a divisive election year. Moral values grow out of our calling as religious people to work to create a beloved community. Moral values instruct us to love our neighbors as ourselves and to ask the question, who is my neighbor? They are fundamentally inclusive rather than exclusive, and they call on generosity of spirit rather than mean-spiritedness. In this post-election season, let me express some of the moral values held dear by many in the Unitarian Universalist community." This brings us down to cases. "We believe that feeding the hungry and clothing the naked are moral duties, and we will continue to work on behalf of economic justice. We believe that ensuring civil rights for gay and lesbian families is our moral duty, and we will continue to work for marriage equality nationwide. We believe that safeguarding a woman's right to choice is a moral duty. And we will continue, and we will oppose efforts to eliminate or significantly compromise reproductive freedom. We believe that providing affordable health care for all Americans is a moral duty. And we will continue to advocate for medical rights for the young, the old, the frail, and all of those in need. We believe that serving as stewards of the earth is a moral duty. And we will continue to do everything in our power to protect the environment. Along with all that Bill Sinkford cites in his statements, I briefly want to go back to the piece by Derek Jackson that I read earlier. For I do believe, as he indicates, that the largest and most overarching moral issue and question for Americans today is, can we continue to live at the level of material consumption at which we now are and still be a responsible member of the community of nations? If Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson is correct, as cited by Mr. Jackson, that it would take the earthly resources of four planet Earths to sustain the livelihoods of the peoples of the world, if they were living as we do here, how long can such a situation as this remain tenable? This is not a matter that will be adequately resolved in any of our lifetimes. But if some of us do not begin to take that long view again, then I feel Mr. Jackson is right in saying that the ultimate outcome of this set of circumstances will be massive wars by humans over scarce resources. Can we live as a human family over the span of human history? Can we live as a human family over the span of human history? This indeed is the biggest human moral issue of all. It is not one I expect an elected leader of any nation to solve in the course of an administration or two. But it is one for persons of faith to begin at least chipping away at a little. Chipping away. This is a huge journey. And if a huge journey of 1,000, if not 1,000,000 miles, begins with even the smallest of steps, let's start taking at least those small steps and then see where they lead us. We can help the seeds, for instance, that Central American coffee growers get a fair price for their coffee. You do that, a coffee hour every Sunday. We can help to see that persons in 32 mostly third world countries continue or will get a fair price for the work of their creative hands through the 10,000 Villages Exchange. I hope you'll visit that during coffee hour. Lots of small steps that we need to take in order to inch that moral arc of the universe a little further in the direction of justice towards which it ultimately bends. So let me move to a close with this. A few days after the election, I was having some email correspondence with an acquaintance of mine in London who edits a magazine I occasionally write for when I put on my Deep Generation Wider Researcher aficionado hat. After I dealt with some magazine business I needed to cover with him, I just needed a place to kind of go on a tear for a while. And so I figured somebody in another country, say 3,000 miles away, would be about as good a dumping ground as any. So I let this poor guy have it instead. Given his own leanings and sentiments, my friend Kevin was quite sympathetic. And then at the end of his email reply to me, he said, "Look, just do good wherever you can." It may be a bit of a stretch for me to extrapolate from these words from a British friend of mine to what many of the people of the world are looking for and wanting from the American people, but I'll make the stretch anyway. People in various other parts of the world may not understand our political system and processes all that well. They may not understand the outcomes they produce, but I still think they look to us. We rank and file citizens who care about our country and our world, to do good where we can. It's not so much to ask of us, really, if we just do it. It would be foolish and naive to deny that there are serious social, cultural, and religious divisions amongst us as a nation right now, because those divisions clearly exist. But it would also be a mistake, I feel, to overplay those differences. For we are not, to use the current color metaphor, a nation of starkly and exclusively red or blue states. If you break out or break down that color metaphor further throughout the cities, towns, counties, and communities that make up this land, you will see much more of a blend of the blue and the red going clear across this land. And all we can do is be in that blend, seeking and acting upon ways to do good where we can. All we can do is be in that blend, living out the moral values we hold dear, in the faith and in the hope that we are advancing that journey towards greater human justice and wholeness, and not impeding or reversing it. And that we are being careful rather than careless with this fragile planet we've been given to live on. This is all we can do. And we can hope and pray that it will be enough. I give thanks for our community, like the one we have here, and to which we have welcomed new members this morning. It's imperfect, to be sure, as all human communities are. And yet it is one in which we seek to move our lives towards greater spiritual depth for ourselves and towards a greater commitment to the common human good for all. So let us recommit and rededicate ourselves to the care of this community on this day and in our days ahead together. We need one another, and we need to be attending to a world that beckons us to do good where we can. Our closing hymn is number 300, with heart and mind. Let's sing that together.